Welcome to The Victory Kitchen, the podcast all about American food rationing during World War II. I'm your host, Sarah Creviston Lee, author, historian, and vintage foodie. I'll be exploring the logistics of food rationing, featuring wartime cookbooks and recipes, and highlighting real homefront experiences. We're going to be learning exactly what our grandmothers had to do to get their food to fight for victory. Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Victory Kitchen. This is episode 26. When you think of wartime rationing and eating and how people went about cooking that food, what usually comes to mind? It might be the standard middle-class suburban home kitchen with a stove, an oven, and one of those tanks of a refrigerator to keep the food cold. And you wouldn't be wrong. A lot of people had those. The next few episodes, I'm going to be focusing on the spaces where rationing in America was found. However, some of these places aren't ones we would necessarily think of first, but were definitely part of the American landscape when it came to wartime eating. For this episode, we're going to be looking at trailers and kitchenettes in apartments, along with some other interesting living arrangements. The tiny spaces that so many Americans were forced to cook in, either because of economic circumstances or because of the severe lack of housing near factories, plants, and shipyards. Later in the episode, I'll be interviewing Jesse Williams, a Tennessee museum professional who is from near Oak Ridge, Tennessee, home of the top secret facility nicknamed Atomic City, where they enriched uranium during World War II for the Manhattan Project. We will be talking about the extreme living situations people dealt with in Oak Ridge while working there, including how they cooked food or didn't. To start off with, we need to set the stage for what was termed as the quote-unquote defense housing problem. There was a housing shortage before the war. But once the U.S. entered World War II, the housing shortage problem just got worse. Factories were built and upgraded for war production or retrofitted to make war products. Towns with these factories that maybe once were regular-sized, sleepy towns suddenly turned into boom towns as people streamed in for better-paying factory and defense jobs. No doubt the local people found this frustrating and the influx of people very annoying. There weren't enough resources to support them, there weren't enough houses or rooms to put them in, and to make matters worse, because of the war, there were restrictions and rationing on building materials. It was a real problem. In the August 17, 1942 issue of Life, there is an article about the dire need for housing in Detroit. The government wanted to build Bomber City, in quotes, to house 33,000 Willow Run Bomber plant workers, but they were facing a lot of difficulties. The photographs in this article reveal a lot of various housing situations, from some sleek, completed government apartments to the Sojourner Truth Project that housed Black defense workers and met with white racist opposition that culminated in a violent race riot. There were worker shacks and an extremely patched up shack to trailers and trailer parks and even tents. People lived wherever and however they could. An article in the July 1942 Women's Home Companion called America Builds, written by John Bainbridge, gave a very impassioned plea in defense of these migrating people. He said, "Swarming into industrial centers, oftener than not already overcrowded and looking for a place to live, these are the people who have created what is usually called, somewhat coldly and quite inaccurately, the defense housing problem. The term is inaccurate because these people, this army behind the army, are building implements, not for defense, but for victory. They are building planes, tanks, guns, ships, and ammunition. They make what it takes to do business with Hitler and Hirohito. Chances are they will never be decorated, never have their names inscribed on a roll of honor, and after the war, their honorable discharge may take the form of a dismissal slip in their pay envelopes. Yet their presence now on the home front is no less essential to the final outcome of the war than, say, their brothers or their neighbors on the battlefront. Courage and sacrifice, General MacArthur has said, are no longer enough to win a war. Give us the tools, men fighting for democracy all over the world are saying, and we will finish the job. To make those tools, and to make them fast and well, the men who forge them need a decent place to live. I found this paragraph so powerful. What he's saying is, stop complaining. These people are the ones that are behind the soldiers helping to win the war, and without them, we won't. So in order to solve this incredibly huge problem of housing, we're going to back up a little bit. And what they needed to do was the government needed to create a federally financed housing program. This was the big key to solving the problem. Before the war, President Roosevelt had stated that a third of the country was ill-housed. And then they had to find housing in all of these towns across the country where collectively a few million people had shown up at these factory jobs. And this was happening before we had even entered the war, you know, all these factory defense jobs. President Roosevelt divided the problem between 16 government agencies. And if you know anything about how government works, can you guess how that panned out? Apparently, there was a lot of name calling, more fighting amongst each other than building houses. And then getting congressional approval for funds was another matter. Some lawmakers insisted the war was made up, while others were afraid, quote, homes built for war workers would be too luxurious. Their idea of luxury, it turned out, meant houses equipped with furnaces and refrigerators. Why not cut out all these frills? A low-powered congressman from Michigan thoughtfully inquired, close quote. So, that's interesting. Still others objected flatly to government being in the business of building houses. And a final group protested that the program would stifle the private building industry and ruin the country for sure. And this is all from the article in the Women's Home Companion. So there were a lot of differing opinions about how this housing crisis could be resolved. And they were all legitimate concerns. But in the meantime, while they were bickering, nothing was getting done. Now, they did finally manage to get the funds from Congress, but it was difficult to get them to spend the funds because they'd never built government housing on a scale like this before. All of this, of course, was before the tragedy of Pearl Harbor. But once Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, it brought things into severe focus. President Roosevelt reformed the whole program and brought it under one agency, and that was the National Housing Agency, which was put under the administration of John B. Blandford Jr. Now, it's kind of ironic. The National Housing Agency operated out of their own cramped quarters, which I find it interesting that they highlight this in the article. It says, Mr. Blandford and his staff can scarcely forget the compelling urgency of their job since they have a housing problem of their own. Their quarters in an old residential building in Washington are so cramped that several officials have to work in the kitchen and butler's pantry. Others perspire freely at their desks in the attic, while still others carry on in a pair of trailers parked in the agency's backyard. So while they're working on this housing problem, it sounds like it would be very hard to forget what they were working for. So at this point, the article continues. In 280 different localities across the country, the government is putting up houses by the thousands for the men who are fighting on the production front. In addition, in many other regions, clean, comfortable dormitories are being built for single men and for men who, as many must in war, leave their families behind. Gigantic to begin with, the undertaking grows greater by the day. Before the year is out, the government will have built well over a quarter of a million houses. Flying by plane across the country these days, you would see in scores of places below evidence of the mighty housing program in progress. Tractors digging foundations, workmen pouring concrete, carpenters laying roofs, and finally people unloading furniture moving in. But to see what's really going on, you would need to come down in one of these localities and have a look around. What they do in this article is they go to one of these locations and they kind of zero in on it and get down to some details. And the place that they focus on is Beaver County, Pennsylvania. This was a place that was classed as a critical housing area. They had 10,000 people come to live there in 1941. And then they estimated that 12,000 more would come that year in 1942. But it was so serious. People were living in an abandoned glass factory that had been fixed up for living accommodations. Some were living in tents and trailers. Others were living in this old rickety hotel that had been closed up for years. And in normal times, it would not have attracted any patrons, but it was packed full of people. So in this county, the government was building 10 housing projects to ease the housing crisis burden that was there. Next, we're going to be looking at one of these government housing projects that was featured in an article in the same Women's Home Companion magazine from July of 1942 called Trailer Town, Three Cheers. But before we do that, I just wanted to make a note here that housing has always been connected to socioeconomic and race issues. You see that today, and it was definitely apparent back then in wartime. And something I've noticed is, especially in these women magazines, is that all the articles are almost always about white people. And that's, you know, what they chose to focus on. Now, in Life magazine, at least, they do focus on, you know, people of varying backgrounds. And so, you know, in the Life magazine article, I mentioned earlier about the Sojourner Truth project, housing project, that came from the Life magazine article. And so I will have links for these various things on my blog post that you can learn more about, because I don't have time to go into more details. But I wanted to bring this up just because I feel like, especially when it comes to trailers and trailer parks, there is just something connected to that in our American society. And even something that, you know, people tend to look down on people who live there. And it's really unfortunate because, especially like looking at in this wartime era, this was a type of living situation. People were so grateful to have these trailers to live in. And I just have such compassion for people who are living in these even reduced circumstances from a trailer, just living in tents or, you know, very patched up shacks. And a trailer was a step up from that. People live in whatever circumstances that they are able to. And that is the same today. So it's unfortunate that that is how people view people who live in trailers. I actually myself lived in a trailer as a child for a short time. And it was a very small trailer for a family of five. And my sister and I shared a small bedroom. We had to choose between furniture or a bed, and like a bunk bed. We decided to keep our furniture, and so we slept on the floor in sleeping bags, and that for a whole school year. And that is a very interesting memory that I have, just because the bedroom was so small. But, you know, it built character. So it's just, I really have a lot of compassion for these people. And as I go through this section talking about trailers, you'll see that even within this section, it varied so greatly, people's experiences. Now, in this article entitled Trailer Town, Three Cheers, the subtitle is, "It's to keep Martin bombers rolling out of the factories night and day that these people have cheerfully given up their homes in different parts of the country to live in the cramped quarters of trailers. With the true American spirit, everybody is making the best of the situation and even getting some fun out of this strange new way of living. Why trailers? Because there aren't enough houses and there must be no let up on bombers." So already we start out, and it's a very cheerful attitude. So the overall vibe of this article, everyone's friendly, trailers are cozy, things are convenient, like there's vegetable delivery to your door. That's nice. There's twice daily mail delivery. There's a water pump at every street. So I'm guessing no running water in the trailers. So many people to socialize with, even a bicycle club. Am definitely emphasizing the positives. And it's definitely an all-white community, so no racial mixing. There are a lot of pictures that go with this little highlight of this trailer park. And they're all happy and just cheerful people. And they say they love trailer park living. They just can't say enough good things about it. So that is that article. So definitely a happy story. Then there's another article also in this Women's Home Companion from July 1942. They had quite a few articles focusing on these housing situations. This story is about Frank Webster. It says, Frank Webster works in the aircraft factory. His job is final testing of the engines to make sure they will perform perfectly on their distant and dangerous enterprises. He lives with his wife and four young children in a one-room trailer parked in an auto court in California. He lives there not because he likes it or because he can't afford something better, he averages $46 a week, but simply because he cannot find a house or a reasonable facsimile of a house. He has been trying since he and his family arrived in California 10 months ago. Like a boomtown in the gold rush days of 49, some 4,000 men, about half of them with families, had flocked into a community where a few hundred peaceful citizens had been living and enjoying the climate before. The newcomers, all with money in their pockets to pay for a room, were sleeping in cars, in basements, on benches in the park. A man who found a decent place to live was regarded as about as lucky as a prospector who struck it rich a century before. Frank Webster thought he was pretty lucky when he was able to rent a couple of sleeping rooms at $20 a week in a ramshackle boarding house, but he soon found that what he had discovered was nothing but fool's gold. Five other families in the rooming house shared the same bathroom. The children had no place to play except on a busy street. Mrs. Webster found it hard to cook on a two-burner gas plate, and she didn't know what to do about the roaches. When she asked the landlord, he shrugged and said the bugs went with the place at no extra charge. In the trailer, which Frank Webster rented a while later at $18 a week, there are no bugs. Nor, for that matter, is there a bathroom or much of a place to do the laundry or cook or sleep. So, as you can see, it wasn't for lack of trying. He really wanted to live in a house, and a trailer was the best that he could come up with. I don't think they wanted to live in a trailer. There was no bathroom, nowhere to do laundry or cook, and he says, or sleep. I'm not sure how they lived. I think they probably had some way to sleep in there, just it wasn't very comfortable for his family of six. That would be very cramped. But at least there were no roaches in there. So, wow. Now, that is his experience. Contrast that to an article I found later in the war from Life magazine, September 25th, 1944. This account comes from the article State of the Union, Passages from a Famous Novelist's Bestseller and Some News Pictures by John Dos Passos. This is from Detroit, Michigan. It was a cold Sunday morning. We were sitting on top of the Sunday papers littered over the couch of a trailer, talking in low voices because the baby was asleep in the bunk at the other end. It was warm in the trailer. Everything was very still. Through the window, you could see the aluminum ends of the other trailers in the row. Some bare trees, a corner of a white farmhouse, and rolling hilly country. The husband had broad shoulders and black hair and broad cheekbones and wide, even white teeth. He looked as if he had some French-Canadian in his ancestry. He'd been studying at the state normal school to be a teacher. Then he'd worked in Flint and in a soybean factory. Since he'd married and the baby had come, he'd bought himself a trailer and had come down to do war work in the enormous bomber plant that had just been completed down the road. Before gasoline and tires had gotten so scarce, he was saying, there had been some point to living in a trailer, but now that it was a permanent stationary residence, he wondered. Still, around here a man was lucky if he had any place to live at all. It was particularly hard on a woman with a baby. no way of getting away, no place to put the baby where it would be out of earshot. It wasn't so bad for a man who went to work every day, but women were getting what they called trailer wacky. Here they were at least 5 miles from the nearest town. No chance for his wife to get in to see movies or go shopping very often. Well, he guessed it might be worse. The wife, a well-set blonde girl with a rather bleak look on her face, came back from the laundry across the yard. First, she rushed to the gasoline stove to look at something that was cooking in a roasting pan. A smell of hot meat juice trickled out. The baby, who had started to yell, was brought out and introduced, a clean, healthy-looking infant. Of course, his wife said it was interesting getting to know the other people in the camp. No, not many of them were from out of the state. There were 2 girls from West Virginia. They came from all kinds of occupations. Milk routes, screen door factories, law offices, photographers, insurance salesmen. It was interesting that way. Of course, a trailer was an easy place to keep clean, but after you had done your housework and your washing, what then? That was the problem. She got a lot of reading done. It was all right Sundays when he was home. The two of them looked at each other and smiled. The wife suddenly looked very pretty. This, you know, different attitude about living in a trailer, especially towards the end of the war, when, you know, living in a trailer was starting to feel more permanent. And we get to see some of the problems where, yeah, there's nowhere to get away because you're living in one room. And if you live far from town, there's nothing to do. And you're kind of stuck with just getting to know your neighbors, and that's about it. And with, you know, gas and rubber rationing, getting out to go to town would be extremely difficult. So, and it's interesting that they'd come up with a term, trailer wacky, for this feeling of feeling crazy with nowhere to go. I like that they mention, you know, that she's cooking something in this gasoline stove in a roasting pan. I wonder if they literally meant a gasoline stove. Maybe they did. I don't know. That sounds scary to me. I found this interesting picture in the newspapers about one guy who solved his housing problem for himself. He built himself a bicycle trailer. The caption says, "Prospects of national gasoline rationing gave John Davis of Fort Worth, Texas, the urge to build a bicycle trailer. Light and compact, the outfit includes a bunk, hot plate, cooking utensils, blankets, guitar, and a hammock for Davis's dogs." That was from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, 21st of June, 1942. And it shows him standing proudly with his bicycle and this kind of long trailer with a window, and it looks very impressive. It can go anywhere. It's kind of short, though. I think it comes to like mid-waist. So, yeah. Good for him. Portable trailer. The next section is about apartments. Apartments and tenements definitely weren't new to the American living landscape. They'd been around in some form or other for as long as they've been cramming people into cities. Many people lived in boarding houses or hotel rooms without kitchens at all and just dined out all the time or had communal kitchen areas. Kitchenettes were common in apartments. Now, a kitchenette is defined as any kitchen space that's smaller than 80 square feet. Skimming through wartime newspapers, I saw numerous advertisements for furnished rooms for rent, not even apartments. You know, these were just furnished rooms. In some cases, they specified the rooms had kitchen privileges. Other times, they said the rooms for rent had a furnished room with hot plate for cooking, so they allowed cooking in the room itself. One ad said, "For rent, furnished, housekeeping, sleeping room for 2 girls, close to bus line, hot plate cooking allowed." So I found those very interesting. The quality of apartment living definitely varied as well, but unfortunately we don't have time for that in this discussion. But now we get down to the crux of this discussion. I mean, all of that was kind of leading up to my favorite part, and that is 1940s tiny space cooking technology. Now, what's interesting to look at is how they cooked in these spaces in the 1940s. Electricity and the explosion of new electrical gadgets changed how many people were able to conveniently cook in small spaces. You didn't even technically need a standard stove or oven anymore. There were hot plates, you know, electric, gas, maybe propane powered, portable ovens. These were non-electric. They just set atop the electrical hot plates or gas hot plates. There were toasters, waffle irons, and broilers. My friend Kelsey sent me a little article from the Canadian magazine Maclean's, dated 1st of June, 1943. This is a perfect reflection of what was going on in America at the time as well. It's called Happily Ever After by Helen G. Campbell. In the introduction to the article, it says, "Brides these days have their own particular problems. They are setting up housekeeping in a pint-sized all-in-one room. They're leading a double life, career girls from 9 to 5 and housekeepers after that. They're serving meals at odd hours to keep up with shifting shifts. But they're having fun and living happily ever after in spite of it all. For the all-in-one room housekeeper, menus built around dishes which can be prepared on a two-burner hot plate. If you have a portable oven, all the better." Now, I had to look up what a portable oven was. It looks like a lightweight toaster oven without any electronics except a basic temperature gauge on the front that you set on electrical or a gas hot plate. And I actually found a picture of one online, so I have the link on my blog so that you can go look at it. It is a nifty looking thing. I will be on the hunt for one because it just looks so cool. And so in this article, it just has all these delicious recipes that you can make on a two-burner hot plate. And the picture that goes with this article is super cute too. It has the young bride fixing up the meal for her soldier husband, and she's just beaming down at him, and he's looking with excitement at what she's preparing. And so super cute and adorable. And I just find that really, really fun and interesting, because this two burner hot plate thing was the appliance of the day. Now, these miracle appliances weren't without their risk. I found a couple articles in the newspapers talking about accidents involving them. One talked about children being overcome by gas from a hot plate cooking stove. I'm guessing this is a gasoline powered one. Luckily, they were saved. Thank goodness. Another article talked about how tenants of two apartment buildings kept overloading the electrical circuits. Why? Because of the heavy use of electrical hot plates for cooking, which had blown out the fuses installed just a few hours before. It says the electrician also found that one electrical circuit so overheated that the head of a screw on a nearby conduit box had melted off by the heat. That's crazy. So needless to say, the tenants were ordered not to use hot plates for cooking. So it sounded like everyone was using them. And I wondered, if they were ordered not to use them, what did they use instead? Because if they were using hot plates, was it due to convenience? Was it because they didn't have an alternative? I just have so many questions. Now, what's exciting is that this episode's cookbook feature, we're going to be putting a spotlight on cooking in small spaces, and which we will be talking about later. But one last thing I wanted to mention is that there is some exciting wartime literature that the wartime housing crisis is woven into the story. So these titles that, at least ones that I have read, I'm sure there's more out there, but these are ones that I have read. These are Since You Went Away by Margaret Buell Wilder, Suds in Your Eye by Mary Laswell. That's a fun one. And A Tower of Steel by Josephine Lawrence. And they also all mention cooking and food in them. So that's always a bonus for me. I just find it so fascinating in these books written in the wartime era when they weave in details of wartime living and what it was like during that time period. There is no better way to study extreme wartime living conditions than to learn about Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And with that, we can go to my interview with Jesse Williams. Jesse Williams is a native of Tennessee whose family has been there since the 1790s before the state was formed. He's worked with many preservation groups as a volunteer and has served as the curator of Belle Meade Plantation in Nashville, Tennessee, and most recently served as an emergency temporary curator of Liberty Hall in Frankfort, Kentucky. He has experience researching and interpreting history across any era, but he's most passionate about his work with the World War II homefront experience in Tennessee. While still in college, he served on the board of the Secret City Festival, as well as the preservation effort to save the only hotel built for the Manhattan Project located in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. He has collected items pertaining to this Tennessee wartime experience and even salvaged one of the homes constructed for the Oak Ridge Project in 2013. During the pandemic, he started a YouTube page for fun called The Southern Antiquarian, where he shares crafts, projects, and history. Welcome to my podcast, Jesse.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
Yes, I'm so excited we can finally do this interview. I know we've been talking about it for a while. Yes.
Love listening to your podcast.
Thank you. So we are good friends on Instagram and have chatted quite a bit about Oak Ridge in the past. So I was very excited to bring you in on this discussion on unconventional and small living conditions that people were forced to live and cook in during due to wartime conditions. And Oak Ridge, Tennessee is a unique place. And so the nature of this place was that no one knew what anyone else was doing, and no one even knew the significance of what their work was or what it was for. So when they heard the news of the atomic bombs, the people of Oak Ridge were floored. So it's very important to say that while we'll be talking about rather mundane things like housing, kitchens, and cooking in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, our discussion in no way makes light of the work they were doing there or the eventual fact that the uranium made at Oak Ridge was used to produce the atomic bombs that resulted in devastating loss of life in Japan and the generational impact that it's had there. So I thought it was really important to say that. So Oak Ridge, Tennessee, I thought we should do a small introduction for those who may be unfamiliar with Oak Ridge. So what was it and what made it such a different and sometimes crazy place to live? I thought you could give us a little introduction to this place.
Yeah, absolutely. So Oak Ridge didn't exist before 1942. In 1942, Leslie Groves, who was the general in charge of the Manhattan Project, he just finished the Pentagon, purchased 90,000 acres in the middle of nowhere, Tennessee, in the mountains. And they moved out the locals, about 3,000 residents, and they started one of the largest construction projects in American history. And some say it's the Manhattan Project as a whole was the largest industrial project in the history of the world for one single purpose. And that was to create the atomic bomb. And as you mentioned, many of the people working in Oak Ridge had no idea that's what they were doing. I think that's one of the most fascinating aspects of Oak Ridge is it went from being a non-existent city to a city of 75,000 people from 1942 to 1945. And that made it the fifth largest city in the state of Tennessee. It was not on any maps and no one was supposed to know it existed. The city was built to support the enrichment of uranium through several plants. K-25 was the biggest and most important in this operation. And at the time when it was finished, it was the largest building in the world and under one roof. It covered 44 acres in total. Wow. Under one roof. And that was just with the gaseous diffusion plant to separate the uranium to create the materials used to build the bomb.
Wow. That's huge. It's just like hard to even fathom the size of a building that big.
Right. And then, you know, at the same time, they had to support that building being built with a city and they had to keep those mm-hmm. people happy. So, you know, they weren't only building housing, they were building theaters and skating rinks and swimming pools and schools for the kids that were coming with their families. So this was a huge, huge project that, you know, it was just a couple farmhouses and, you know, maybe a post office pre-1942. And again, by 1945, it was a city of 75,000 people.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, earlier in my podcast, I talk about how like these little towns go from, you know, just sleepy little towns to boom towns just because of factories happen to be there. But I mean, right. This is on a completely different scale. It's insane. So the types of housing that they were building, and that's kind of what we're going to be focusing on for our discussion. What's the types of housing that they were building for these people?
It's really important to point out that the city setup of Oak Ridge, and when it was being built in 1942 to 45, it was actually known as Clinton Engineering Works, which was its code name. The term Oak Ridge didn't exist because it wasn't supposed to be there. So when they built the city, it was very specifically built with a hierarchy of jobs, race, and color. With all the different jobs that were going on, if you were a high-ranking scientist working on something and your family was there, you had a very nice rancher house, you had a very nice living condition, and then it went downhill from there quite drastically to the African-American workforce who were in huts. So there was a wide range as well based on marital status. Single people were generally put into dormitory-like situations, which, you know, were just like a college dorm. There wasn't kitchens, there wasn't, you know, living spaces. It was just sleeping arrangements. And at some points, they actually had rotating bed schedules to where they didn't have enough beds. And, you know, Joe got the bed in the morning shift and Jim got it in the afternoon shift. As things were being built, that would be hard to adjust to as well. But there was also single family homes, dependencies as far as efficiency apartments, full apartments, pretty much anything you would expect to see in a regular city, you would see in Oak Ridge by 1945. Now, a lot of them were designed to be built quickly. My favorite kind is called a flat top. There's several iterations of the flat top, a B1 through all the houses have some weird name as far as a letter and a number indicating size, shape, and income that they would tax you on.
So they called them alphabet housing.
Right.
I guess. Right. Yeah. And then, it's because they went A, B, C.
And then there was a whole nother level of alphabet indicating which dormitory you were in. And all the street names were named after states. So, you know, your address would be Tennessee Avenue, B1, whatever number the house was. And it got very, very confusing. And the rate at which they had to construct this city was unheard of. So they actually turned to the Tennessee Valley Authority, who had developed these prefabricated homes for the construction of Fontana Dam, also in Tennessee. And they mass produced these prefabricated houses. And based on what style the house was they just had them all ready to go. They had the furniture in the sections. So at one point, you know, you could pull up, most of the B1s were 3 to 4 sections, a bedroom, living room, bedroom, hallway, kitchen, bathroom, and bedroom. They would just pull them in and bolt them together, and ready-made houses, furniture ready to go, kitchen equipment stocked. You know, you just have to bring your clothes and food pretty much to move in.
Wow. And they were made from this interesting, was it a new material? It's like a combination of asbestos and cement. They called Semesto.
Semesto, yes. Those were some of the more homes that were built to be more substantial. A lot more of the rancher homes were. A lot of the prefabricated homes down to the hutments were actually constructed out of straight plywood. Every aspect of them are plywood. The kitchen cabinets, the furniture that was in it, the roof, everything was plywood. There were some developments made to make things easier and quicker. Cementos buildings are kind of what we would associate with asbestos siding, you know, the stuff that lasts forever and people leave it alone because they don't want to mess with it. But it made the houses very durable. When the construction of Oak Ridge started, it was supposed to be a temporary city. It was not supposed to stay there. It was supposed to be for this one purpose. Los Alamos, which was another branch of the Manhattan Project, and Hanford, Washington, were also built to be temporary towns. But Oak Ridge was the only one that really survived. And a lot of it is A lot of people say it's because the housing was so well built with this new product that it was so low maintenance. They were just like, well, we'll keep it and sell it off. And Oak Ridge National Laboratory was birthed from this research project with the atomic bomb. So the city is very long lasting in the sense that a lot of these homes that were built, even the flat tops that are completely plywood, were built to last a maximum of 10 years. And people are still living in them. Most of the housing in the city is still Manhattan era project.
That's amazing. So there were some that were that Cementos. Yes. Okay. And then some were just plywood, like the...
The flat tops were totally plywood. They would be brought in three sections, usually four if it was a bigger house. They just bolted them right together. They were fully equipped with your furniture, your kitchen appliances, even sometimes pots and pans. And then you were ready to go. Even the curtains were already up. So you just moved in with your personal effects and, you know, had to go to the store and get your own rationed food items. But your house was ready to go. One of my favorite stories from Oak Ridge, I met one of the ladies. She's now passed away. She was a small child when her family moved to Oak Ridge in 1943. And her house was the first flat top that had been put in at the end of this cul-de-sac. And she went to school on the school bus. Her house was the only one on the street. And when she came home after school, the entire street had been assembled and people were already moving in. And she got off the school bus and all the flat tops were the same. They same color, same shape, everything. And she had no idea what house was hers. So she just stood in the street and cried until all these random house moms housewives who had never met each other found this crying child and had to go door to door to find her mom because she didn't know which house was hers. That was the rate that the city was being built.
Oh my gosh, the poor thing. Right. She'd be so confused.
I think she was still traumatized by it when I met her, and she was in her 80s at that point. Yeah.
Oh, no. That would be so scary, though. I mean, you come home, like, this is your new home, and it looks one way. You go to school, and then boom. Right. It's just not the same neighborhood. That's incredible that they're able to build it that fast. And so one of the books that you can read about atomic, you know, a nickname for this town was Atomic City. It's called The Girls of Atomic City. And they talk about, a lot of the stories talk about the mud because they just didn't have time to build sidewalks.
Yes, and so or roads.
Yeah, or roads. And so girls, like, going to work, they would just carry their shoes. They would walk barefoot to work and carry their shoes above their heads.
There's actually an award in Oak Ridge for people who are still alive who survived it. And it's the Muddy Boot Award. And it's like a bronze muddy boot that that's one of the most prevalent stories of how bad the living conditions were when things started, how bad the shortages were for heating and cooking oil, and how bad the food supply was are the three things that you hear the most of. The roads, the food, and people got really cold because they couldn't get the oil for the heating shipped in fast enough.
Oh my goodness. Wow. And well, I mean, it's easy to imagine just because there's just so many people, you know?
Right.
So you were able to rescue a house, one of these houses. I was wondering if you could tell us.
Yes, one of the flat.
Yeah. Tops. Tell us a little bit about that and some of the items that you were able to rescue from there.
Yeah. So another weird aspect to the Oak Ridge story is when the city was opened. So before 1948, you could not just go to Oak Ridge. People in the area knew what it was. People in the world knew it existed after the bombs were dropped. But you could not enter or exit the city without an ID badge, papers, your car was searched. You couldn't have a camera. You couldn't have alcohol. There was all these things that were not allowed. And it wasn't until 1949 that the city opened and the government deaccessioned or decommissioned a lot of the housing and sold it off to private people. In doing so, they sold off a lot of the camper trailers and they sold off a lot of the flat top houses because they wanted to replace them with more substantial homes. So a lot of people in East Tennessee bought these flat top houses for little next to nothing and moved them out into the mountains for hunting lodges or, you know, in the backyard for a mother-in-law's apartment. And today, when you're driving through East Tennessee and you know what to look for, you can say, oh, that's a flat top. Oh, that's a flat top. Usually they've had, you know, gables put on them in regular roofs because the flat tops leak so bad. But there was one that was going to be burnt. This farmer no longer wished to keep the house. He was putting in a modern trailer in. And I was given 2 days to salvage whatever I could. I was most interested in saving the kitchen. They have very substantial cabinets made out of plywood, and it's a really cool look. I just really like the kitchen. I had hoped to eventually, and I still hope to build it back one day, but I was able to save all the windows, all the doors. This one had never been updated, so it had the original light fixtures.
Wow.
Pretty much everything. I was able to save everything except for the plywood walls, and to be honest, they were so rotten after, you know, 70 something years at this point. But yeah, just the walls aren't even 2x4s. They're 2x2s. So it's 2x2s with like 1/4-inch plywood on both sides for interior and exterior, and no insulation whatsoever in these homes. So it was a fun project to salvage and save. And like I said, I hope to one day be able to build it back. I used to have these great grandiose ideas of starting my own museum, homefront museum in Tennessee. But we'll see where that goes in my retirement, maybe.
Well, I will cheer you on for that because I would come. That sounds like a great goal. And I mean, this is a little sidetrack, but isn't there still one of the buildings left where people work, like a lab there left from the war?
Yes. Y-12 and X-10, they're all named secret names, but they keep those. Y-12 evolved into Oak Ridge National Laboratory. And if you've ever had an MRI, or if you've ever had a family member have radiation treatment for cancer, all of that stuff has developed from Oak Ridge. So Oak Ridge has a really dark past with the creation of the atomic bomb and, you know, the atrocities that came with that. But the materials that they were able to make and how it evolved, most of the world's medical radioactive materials come out of Oak Ridge, and they have really reinvented themselves, and they're really doing some good today. We really owe a lot to the research that's been done at Oak Ridge through the Oak Ridge National Laboratories.
Wow, that's really good to know. Because I just thought, like, if they kept all the houses there, like, did a lot of people stay? And, you know, what would they do there if they were there?
There was a mass exodus. Yeah, there was a mass exodus once people realized that the atomic bomb, they had had a part in that. You know, it's controversial now. It was even more controversial then. And especially when these people didn't know that they were working to, you know, make this super weapon and usher in the Cold War. There was a mass exodus of people who no longer wished to be associated with it, but also it was the end of the war and they wanted to get back to their normal lives. The war work, you know, was kind of over. But no, a lot of people stayed, a lot of the scientists stayed. And the weird thing about Oak Ridge is, you know, Tennessee kind of has a bad reputation for, you know, especially East Tennessee, of just hillbillies and moonshine stills. And, you know, unfortunately, that's still what's marketed heavily. But some of the world's leading scientists came to Oak Ridge, and a lot of them stayed. It brought a level of culture that had never been seen before. There was the first symphony in East Tennessee was put together by these people who had come and their wives. You have to remember that a lot of these scientists' wives were not always housewives who came. They were, a lot of them were also working women who were scientists and, you know, had their own careers before they had to move with their husbands. So Oak Ridge not only enriched uranium, it enriched the lives of East Tennesseans.
That is so fascinating. And we don't usually think about that aspect of the how it just changed the culture of a state by this influx of people. So that is really interesting. When it comes to dormitories, I wanted to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah.
Where would they go to get food? They obviously couldn't cook. There's like a no cooking rule in quite a few of the housing arrangements, like the dormitories. There was a no cooking rule.
Right. Oh. Well, they were all wood, so they were really just afraid that they'd get all these things built and somebody would accidentally set them on fire.
Yeah.
So a lot of those cooking regulations don't really come from the fact that they were trying to force people to eat the bad food at their cafeterias. It mm-hmm. was more of a safety issue.
Okay.
No cooking and also no alcohol. There were Oak Ridge was a dry city until 1949 because they didn't want anybody being hungover working on an atomic device, you know, and blowing up the town. Right. So, yeah, there was a very practical aspect to that, that most of the town was wood and they didn't want some great Chicago fire, you know, scenario happening.
Yeah. Well, some people did find ways to get around the no cooking rule. And so I have this, the Cookie Behind the Fence cookbook that great you book. Told me about. Yeah. So I wanted to read Margaret Marr's dormitory eggs recipe. She says, during my first 4 years in Oak Ridge, I lived in a dormitory and had very little opportunity to cook. She was from Nicholsville, Kentucky. However, Peg found a way to avoid the long lines at the cafeteria each morning and still eat a hot breakfast without breaking the no cooking rule in the dormitory. Peg and her friends cooked eggs by holding them under the hot tap water in the laundry room. They ate them with crackers for a satisfying meal. So here's the recipe. One egg, hot tap water. Run the hot tap water over the egg for at least 5 minutes. Hopefully, it will be done enough to eat.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. And we were talking about, I mean, you were mentioning about how bad the food was and how hard it was to get food.
Yes.
And there was this other story that I came across in this cookbook, and they were talking about this woman named Jean. They lived in a D house. And she remembers the hardship of grocery shopping for her large family and the scarcity of food, the long lines and the ration stamps. And once she recalls seeing a tall stack of canned hash in the grocery store marked special, which required no ration stamps, she quickly bought the limit, 4 cans. That evening, she chopped up and added some onions to the hash to improve the flavor, then served it to her family for dinner. Later, while cleaning the kitchen and mashing the cans flat, Jean discovered that she had not served her family hash. She had served them Dash, a dog food. Anyway, so, well, I mean,
from what I've heard, the dog food may have been better than the cafeteria food. So she may have still done well.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've heard a lot of is a lot of the eggs would sour and go bad before they could get there. Because, I mean, this is in a remote valley in the mountains. So they had to bring everything in on trucks or trains. And a lot of people weren't used to walking into a cafeteria and smelling rotten eggs and they being served. So I've heard a lot about people losing lots of weight when they came. A lot of this people that were clerical workers were women who had never left home. This was their first experience leaving home and, you know, mom's home cooking. And the food and the restraints of the location made things really gross, evidently. There was a lot of food poisoning and people getting sick from that. And they really had to quickly make an effort to improve the food before they lost their workforce.
Yeah, that would be enough for me to want to quit my job, no matter how much it paid me. That, I don't know if we should talk about the African-American Hutments at this point, because that really leads me to the story of Katie Strickland and her contraband biscuits, because that's exactly what inspired her to do something.
Right.
Because they went to the cafeteria and they were served this food. She swears it was buzzard, like, because they thought it was chicken or something. It wasn't. And she tried to go to the bathroom or the outhouse or whatever they had there. They did not have nice facilities in the African-American camp area.
Not at all.
And they were all occupied because apparently she wasn't the only one that had humongous stomach cramps. And she's like, this is it. This is the final straw. I have to do something about this. So she was a cleaner in one of the buildings. And so they were still building one of the buildings. And so she talked to one of the steel workers and just like, hey, you know, she saw that they were cutting off the ends of these steel beams. She's like, make me some biscuit pans. And so the next day she found 3. So she took those 3 biscuit pans. Like, they're kind of misshapen and not flat. But hey, they were pans.
Right.
And so she got together some materials started making biscuits. She went to her husband's hutment and used the stove there to make some biscuits by leaning them up against a brick. Like it was too hot to like put them on the actual stove.
That would have been an oil stove too. It wouldn't have been, you know, just an oil heat stove.
Yeah. Yeah. And so she baked biscuits for herself, for, you know, those that lived around them, and to use them as bribery for the guards. Like there was definitely a no cook rule in those as well.
Right.
But they looked the other way because of these biscuits. So we could talk about, let's talk about these hutments, because these were
terrible,
not the most pleasant. And see, she had a husband, but she couldn't live with right. him.
They weren't only segregated. They were separated by sex in the African-American section. Yeah, the hutments were little more than a tent, barely more than a tent, really. They were 16 by 16 structures made out of plywood that had screenless windows. So it was kind of like a gazebo that you had closed in, and then the top half you could ratchet out to open up just to get airflow. There was no insulation, and usually 4 to 6 residents shared a hutment, and the living conditions were not great. They did not have hot or cold running water. A communal bathhouse, which was just a hutment that had a shower or a toilet in it, served 12 hutments. So when you do the math to that, that's not a good ratio, and that's probably why she couldn't access the bathroom when she needed to. But these people were doing the dirtiest work, the lowest of the low, the laundry and shipping and the dangerous work of building these plants. So they were definitely exploited and definitely given the worst possible living situation. There are some situations where white men were housed in hutments, but it was more of like a, oh, you stay here until we get this other better place built for you. It was not a long-term housing. And pretty much as soon as the project ended, those hutments were removed. They were in a separate area, and they didn't really want them hanging out around to be seen by the general public once the gates opened.
Yeah. That makes you wonder. Yeah. So they were 16 by 16 foot, and they slept about like 4 to 6 people on cots.
Yes. And then of course the women's area was, fenced off, and they called that the woman's pen, which always, you know, talk about regulating people to animal-like status, just call their housing the pen, you know.
Yeah.
That has always bothered
yes.
me. And they had a strict curfew of 10 o'clock, where most other places didn't have that strict of a curfew.
And then their husband, like they were able to visit their husbands, but the husbands were not able to visit them.
Correct.
And then, but the police guards were able to patrol everywhere, even the women's right. area, and they could come in at any time. Like right. they would just barge in, even if the women were in the middle of dressing, like there was no privacy whatsoever.
Well, that's something that was across the board. It didn't matter if you were in the hutment section or the nicest house in Oak Ridge at the time. If the military police thought for some reason that they needed to search your property, you had no rights. People mm-hmm. would talk about what they were doing or fuss about the city and then disappear. I mean, it wasn't.
Yes.
We still don't know the full story of where some of those people went. I'm sure that there's some dark history there. But yeah, no, there was no such thing as personal property. All the housing was rented, and you could be removed or imprisoned for the most simplest of things. If you wanted to shop in a bigger department store or go to a restaurant, you had to ride the bus to Knoxville or Clinton, Tennessee. And there was pretty much a Gestapo, a secret police that would try to get you to talk about your job or talk about something about town. And if you did, you disappeared. You were removed from the bus, and you know, your girlfriends would say, what happened to Susie? And nobody knew. So the security was extreme because they didn't want anyone to know what was going on.
Yeah. A lot of propaganda around town saying, keep your lips sealed.
Yeah. Loose lips sink ships. Yep.
And people recruited, like random people around town recruited to spy on each other. You just never right. knew who was a spy. It was right. just it could be your spouse.
Yes.
I mean, it was the most unhealthy environment to live in.
Yes.
anywhere.
And then adding radioactivity, and they had no idea what it really did to people too.
Yeah.
The whole reason they picked the area of Tennessee that they did was that each plant was in a different valley. And if one of them exploded, they hoped that the mountain valley would help contain the explosion and not, you know, wipe out Knoxville and all of East Tennessee. So there's some real sinister history there when you really get to looking into it.
Poor Tennessee. Sorry, Tennessee.
Right. Sacrificial lamb in this project for sure.
Yeah. Oh, man. One last thing I thought we could talk about are, you mentioned the trailer houses. Since that's a big theme in this podcast. please tell me about the trailer houses at Oak Ridge.
Yeah, because the city, again, was being built so quickly, they actually bought up every camper that they could find, trailer home, RV, whatever you want to call them today. And these were generally for the construction workers. Outside of K-25, directly across the street, was a huge trailer park that they called Happy Valley. Nothing of Happy Valley exists today. Just the fire hydrants are out in the woods. The trees are all grown back, and you would not know that it was once a huge community. But they were set up very much like the Hutman African-American areas. It was several trailers with one bathhouse for like a communal use. And they had their own grocery store and theater in Happy Valley, but it was a drive-in. So Happy Valley was very temporary. And there was no consistency to what kind of trailer or what brand of trailer. It was really whatever the government could find and purchase. So it's just this big mosh pit of trailers of all kinds. And they had running water and electrical hookups, but they were definitely on the lower end of the social class scale. As most of them were white workers, but they were the labor end of things. They weren't the scientists living in the nice houses in middle of town.
Like blue collar.
Yeah, very blue collar working class.
So they had electrical hookups. So that means they could cook in these trailers. So that was important for their families, at least a step up from everywhere else.
Right.
So they could have a hot plate is probably what they could manage in these places. They probably didn't have ovens, I'm guessing.
I think it depends on the model of the trailer home that you ended up with. Some of them would have had gas stoves. With the shortages of heating oil and gas availability, I don't know how long it would take the gas availability to trickle down to the trailer park side of things, and how much of that would have been consumed in town center.
So if you got lucky,
yeah, you might have some gas if you
it's like, oh honey, look, we've got this great gas powered trailer, but wait, just kidding.
Right. No gas. Yeah. The TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, was building a lot of dams very quickly in this period. Douglas Dam especially was built in record time, and it was built pretty much specifically to provide power to K-25 and the construction processes. And so a lot of the town site and a lot of the trailers relied heavily on electric power, and a lot of the buildings were hardly insulated at all because they had electric heating, and they just crank it up because the electricity was so, you know, quote unquote, cheap and available.
Yeah. Well, and you didn't have to truck it in anywhere. It just came in on the wires. So that makes some more sense. Yeah. So you're more lucky if you had electricity than gas or propane or whatever. Was there anything else that you wanted to cover?
I would like to mention that there's one man that was allowed to have a camera, and his name was Ed Westcott. And all of the images that we have from Oak Ridge, which are thousands and thousands, from the start of the project when they broke the ground to, you know, JFK's visit and later on, was all Ed Westcott. And we would not have the resources that we have, the photographic information that we have, without Ed. I mean, it was his job, but he not only focused on the building of the plants, which was really what he was supposed to do. He captured daily life and really helps historians today understand, you know, just how terrible the living situation in the Hutments were. You know, we can talk about them being bad, but there's photographs of them. You know, we can talk about the food being bad, but you can see the cafeterias where nobody looks happy, you know, without this insight of Ed, which, you know, his work's all over online, if you're interested in looking that up. We owe a lot of the information that we have today to one man, Ed Westcott, and Bill Wilcox, who came as a scientist and became this historian for town. And both of these gentlemen have passed within the last 10 years, and we've lost a huge resource with that. But those two guys had really preserved the story of Oak Ridge and really has made it possible for me to even share what I know with you today.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, they could have just, you know, he could have just taken those pictures, like probably the government wanted him to do, but he, right.
The rich white guys, mm-hmm. you know, focus on the white guys.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm sure he saw what an opportunity and an important thing it was to document right. what was really going on and just the life, I mean, of these people, right. What a treasure he's left for us and for history. So important. And I know you've shared a lot with me from the museum when you went to visit the museum in Oak Ridge. Some of, I'm yes. sure probably all of the images from that museum are from his collection. Are yeah. his. So yes. mm-hmm. They're really incredible. His pictures are incredible works. So we can leave that link on my blog for.
Yeah, it is also important to point out that the structure K25, the largest building in the world that they built for this project, became so radioactive that it was unsafe and it has been torn down. But that is where the museum sits today. So you can overlook the site where the plant was. And the museum is one of the best put together museums that I have ever experienced. And I'm a big museum nerd. So Y12 and X10 are still super secret facilities that you do not want to try to enter, or you may disappear as well. But K25 site is open to the public. There is a very nice museum. They are actually redeveloping that whole campus into a modern technologies industrial park. So they're encouraging modern industries and robotics and things coming in there. So they've really reinvented that site and took something that could have been a terrible blot in making it something that's still affecting the world today.
So you can walk the footprint and just kind of feel the scale of that building.
You cannot walk the footprint because you would glow.
Yeah. You would glow. Okay, so it's like hands off. No, right. You cannot go here.
From a safe, non-cancer causing overlook from the museum. And then,
but
don't want to walk it.
Google Maps. Yes. You can look on Google Maps and right. kind of much get better, a scale.
Much better option. Yeah.
Well, if you want to learn more, I will have lots of links on my blog, including the National Park Service has a link about the African-American Hutments and also about the alphabet letter housing. There's also some great books about that you can read about the, you know, quote unquote Atomic City. Thank you so much for coming on my podcast, Jesse. It's been a lot of fun chatting in person, not just on Instagram.
Right. Thank you for having me.
Today's cookbook feature is Double Quick Cooking for Part-Time Homemakers by Ida Bailey Allen, which was published in 1943. This is another one of my very favorite cookbooks. It's a great wartime cookbook as it is, and if you ever come across a copy, you need to cherish it. It's a very unique book in that it covers time-saving techniques, foods that can be cooked ahead, avoiding food waste. One of my favorite chapters, Gift Foods for Our Servicemen, which is actually quite rare in cookbooks, surprisingly, for wartime, and a chapter all on the carried lunch, another favorite. But what really stood out to me and what sparked the idea for this episode was Chapter 6, Two Burner Dinners and Oven Meals for Kitchenettes and Trailers. I have never seen a chapter on this in any wartime cookbook. So that's what makes this cookbook so unique. So once I found a couple articles about trailer towns, I knew I had a solid episode along with this cookbook chapter. But first, I'm going to read her introduction to this cookbook. It's entitled Part-Time Pioneers. In a public square in Kansas, I saw a statue of a homemaker, a mother of covered wagon days. A baby in her lap, a little child at her knees, a dog at her feet, a musket at hand. A pioneer homemaker on the alert to protect her home. She had a part-time job, too. In fact, she carried on many jobs. She helped to till the fields, raised the vegetables, tended the chickens, milked the cows, churned the butter, smoked the hams, preserved and pickled, did her own sewing, washed the clothes, distilled simple medicines, dipped candles, cooked the food, bore and raised the children in the fear of God. There is only one great difference between that homemaker of yesterday and the homemaker of today. She carried on most of her multiple jobs in the home. You carry on your full-time job away from home. But you, too, are pioneers in industry, in war, on the home front. Like those other pioneer women, you are Americans adventuring in new paths. Like them, you can keep serene, resourceful, strong, purposeful, carry on your two jobs, and protect the health of your families by providing wholesome food. It is for you, the part-time homemakers of this land, that this book is written, in the fervent hope that it may be of service in these critical days and in the brighter days that are to come. Signed, Ida Bailey Allen. So, I actually really like this introduction because it really reflects what I've seen in similar sentiments in articles and even in other cookbooks where they kind of harken back to the pioneer days or Revolutionary War days, which was a very popular theme from that time period. And pulling in those themes of, look at these pioneer women and you are a pioneer too. And they had these skills, but you have these similar skills. We are all doing the same thing. We're protecting our home. We're feeding our families. And they're equally important. Now, when it comes to this chapter 6, the two burner dinners and oven meals for kitchenettes and trailers, I found it very fascinating that what her inspiration was for this chapter was actually the Army. She talks about how when she was on tour with the Army bakers and cook schools, she saw one of the gasoline field stoves on which army cooking was done when troops were on the move. She says, in spite of the fact that there are only two cooking surfaces on which to turn out a hearty meal, the men are abundantly fed. The stoves are transported by truck. The meat or main food, which requires longest cooking, is started at the proper time. The truck rolls along. Soon they start to cook a dessert in the top part of the stove. When that is done, in go the vegetables. The meat is cooked in the middle compartment, which corresponds to the second burner of a hot plate. At serving time, the whole stove is in use, so the final problem is where to make the coffee. Just like home, when you have only two burners, how can we two-burner home cooks adopt army methods and produce man-sized meals? I really love that she's not looking down on these women who have these small spaces, these small cooking implements. And she's actually trying to find a solution for them. And she's fascinated that the Army, if the Army can do it, why can't we in our own homes do it? You know, the Army is making these huge meals to feed all these men. So why can't we just feed our families doing the same methods? And so that's what she does. She answers this question, how can we do this in this chapter? And so she talks about, you know, equipment for top of the stove cooking, quick and slow cooking. And then she has various menus, the procedures, and then the recipes. And she has quite a few of these and just all different kinds of methods that you can experiment with. I've tried the vegetable dumplings. Those are very good. And I've tried fruit dumplings as well. Those were amazing. And so there's a few of these I still want to try. She also talks about oven dinners. So just making good use of your oven. So it's a really fascinating chapter. And I learned a lot reading this. Now, I only tried one recipe from this cookbook, and it's a rather large cookbook, but I wanted to focus on a technique that I've been wanting to try for ages, and that is to use up leftovers of a sort to make something else. And in this case, it is a cake crumb pudding. And what you do is you could Actually, it's called a cookie crumb pudding, but you can use cake as well. And so I wanted to try the cake version. So you take just leftover cake, a day old. It's good to just set it out so it dries out a little bit. I actually made a cake from this same cookbook. It was a Creole spice cake that the base of the sugar was molasses. It was very good cake on its own. It went fast in my house and we had guests over. They loved it. So I made sure to set some aside so it wouldn't get devoured. And I set it out overnight covered with like a tea towel. So it did dry out a little bit. And then I used it for this crumb pudding. All you do is you add an egg mixed with 2.5 cups of milk, and you add 3 tablespoons of honey or sugar. I used honey, and then 1 teaspoon of allspice. Now, because I had made this spice cake and the dominant spice in that was allspice, I opted to change this to cinnamon because my cake did not have any cinnamon in it. And that is kind of the base of the pudding. Then you take 1.5 cups of cookie or cake crumbs. So in my case, cake crumbs, and you crumble it up and then you just mix all of that together. Then you transfer it to shirred egg dishes. Now I used ramekins that I greased them, and I think shirred egg dishes are maybe wider and more shallow than ramekins, because it says to bake in a 375 degree oven until set and firm on the top, about 15 minutes. This was not the case for mine. I think I had to bake mine for 45 minutes because it is a very wet batter. The cake did not soak up all that milk. It's a lot of milk for only 1.5 cups of cake crumbs, but you just bake it until it's set. So whatever dish you happen to be cooking it in, it doesn't matter. Just bake it until it's set. Then you serve warm or cold with top milk, honey, egg sauce, or melted jelly. Now, I had this can of Devon custard that was imported from England that I had been hoarding in my cupboard for a long time. And I was waiting for the best thing, you know, just something to serve it with. And I'd been hoping that it would taste just like the custard I remembered having when I was in England. And this seemed like the perfect thing to serve it with. And oh, it was so perfect. And it did taste like the custard I remembered in England. It is the best British custard. So there's nothing that tastes quite like British custard. So, and this cake crumb pudding was divine. Oh, it was so, so good. Warm. I don't think I'd recommend it cold. I think warm is definitely the way to go. It was absolutely delicious. I would eat it any day. I think the deliciousness of this dessert definitely depends on your base of cake or cookie. So I think chocolate cake would be stellar. It would definitely be over the top. Just amazing dessert, 10 out of 10. So just experiment. It could, you know, whatever cake you think would go well on this type of treatment. I don't know about vanilla. That'd be kind of boring, but you know, you never know with this allspice added in there. Carrot cake could be a good one to go. And now with cookies, I kind of worry about cookies just because cookies are kind of sweet on their own. But keep in mind, this is a wartime cookbook. I would not recommend using a modern cookie recipe for this recipe because they have so much sugar in them. Use a wartime cookie recipe for this recipe. So that's why I made a wartime cake recipe before making this recipe, because I did not want an overload of sugar, because I think it would definitely throw off the balance of what it's supposed to taste like. So anyway, I highly recommend this recipe. It was so delicious, and I may or may not have ordered most of it to myself. Don't tell anyone. So definitely so delicious. I will have this recipe and the Creole spice cake recipe on my blog, because I think you definitely would want to try that one too. It was really good just as a cake by itself. So look forward to that. Today's story highlight comes from Cooking Behind the Fence. And this is the cookbook that I mentioned in my interview with Jesse. And it's the recipes and recollections from the Oak Ridge 43 Club. In the back of the cookbook, they have a collection of memories from the original residents of Oak Ridge, who many of them still live there today. They have memories sprinkled throughout with the recipes, but in the back, they've got a section of just memories. I'm going to be sharing a memory that's entitled Nell Reynolds Remembers. Nell didn't bring any cookbooks with her when she came to Oak Ridge from Nashville in 1943. Cookbooks wouldn't have helped her anyway, since she had to prepare whatever was available from the quote-unquote rolling store that rolled through the trailer camp a few times a week. Nell and her husband Jack and young sons Bobby and John lived in the J.A. Jones trailer camp near K-25, where 12,000 other people lived. The trailer camp was called Happy Valley and had its own post office, grocery store, dry goods store, bowling alley, and picture show. Although the stores were conveniently located to the trailers, Nell discovered it was just too much trouble to drag two small boys through the mud to the stores, then back with their arms full of groceries. And the worst part of it all was trying to get the mud out of their clothes after such an expedition. Nell bought bread, peanut butter, and cans of tuna fish from the rolling store and usually made tuna fish or peanut butter sandwiches for lunch. And if she happened to have enough sugar and butter to spare, she might whip up a chocolate cake using the recipe on the back of the cocoa box. The rolling store was just an old army bus painted olive drab with shelves built inside to hold a limited amount of groceries, but it was a great convenience to Oak Ridge housewives stuck in their trailers in the J.A. Jones trailer camp in Happy Valley. Wow. I can't even imagine living in a trailer camp with so much mud that it was such an inconvenience to go to the grocery store with her two small boys and then having to carry the groceries back. So having that kind of a rolling store that was an old army bus, having that as a boon, that's just kind of crazy to think about. But so awesome that they had that at least to kind of take that burden off of her. But wow, what a memory. And it's just so great that they have gone to so much trouble to preserve these memories in this cookbook. Well, that's it for today's episode. I know this is a long one, but it was such a fascinating topic. And I wanted to thank Jesse for his interview. I had such a good time talking to him and learning more about Oak Ridge. If you don't already, you can follow me on Instagram. My handle is @VictoryKitchenPodcast. You can also support me on Patreon, where I share 3 ration recipes from my personal ration cookbook collection every month. And there's a bunch of other perks for different tiers. And I am so grateful for all of the support from my patrons. Thanks so much for joining me, and I will talk to you next time. Bye!